Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So when you interview people, do you have notes?
Yes.
Oh, you do?
Okay. So do you mean interview people for the podcast?
Well, I don't know. Do you like taking notes or no?
When I interview people for a newspaper or a magazine, I will have a list of questions that I've jotted down that I just have in case of any of those like horrible moments where you're like, I don't know what to say next. I've lost my way. And often when you're interviewing an A-list celebrity and they're on a movie junket, which is where they shepherd in journalists like one after the other and you're given like a 20-minute slot, you only have a finite period of time and you need to win that person over and you need to keep the conversation going. So it's good to be like that prepared. And then while they're speaking, I will take notes because I'm always paranoid that my dictaphone won't work and won't record. But when I'm doing the podcast, it's slightly different because it is so much more relaxed, or at least that's how you got to make it seem. Mm-hmm. So with the podcast, I do a lot of preparation in that I will read and know about the person, and I would have written an introduction that I do. And in a way, writing that introduction is a really good act for me. Like, it crystallizes my thoughts about what's interesting and what I want to discover with them. But because I've asked my guests beforehand for three failures that they don't mind discussing, that provides the scaffolding of the conversation. So actually, I'm a lot freer.
Because you have the structure, and you can always go, if you get stuck or something, you can just go back to, okay, what is your second failure? And
exactly.
You do it that way.
Exactly.
But then when you were doing these junkets and things like that, did you experience anyone, who was the most famous person?
Clint Eastwood is probably one of the most famous. Yeah.
You did Clint Eastwood?
He was amazing.
I interviewed his son.
Oh, Kyle. No.
What's his son?
Cliff.
Stull?
Scott.
I was so close.
Carl, did you say? Carl.
I said Kyle.
Carl Eastwood. No, I interviewed Scott Eastwood and I was making jokes and he really didn't understand my jokes because obviously American, my British humour did not shine through at all. So it became really awkward. And at the end he just went to me, like a jacket. I went, thanks, man.
That's something.
Yeah, that's something. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to part two of Private Parts. Still here with Elizabeth Day. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Jamie. Hi.
So listen, we are incredibly similar.
Yeah, we are, actually.
We are, but in so many ways...
I'm taller, but...
You're taller.
Can I just say, you talk a lot about being little.
Yeah.
But I really don't think that you are that little, and I think that you should stop talking about it and stop drawing attention to something that doesn't exist.
I am little. I'm not that little.
You don't come across like that, though.
It's because of my big personality.
It is. It's because you're really bloated after the weekend.
Yeah, because I just really bloated. How can that guy be so bloated and that short? That's quite a weird look. No, I don't know. I think it probably was an insecurity of mine growing up because whenever I walked into a room, all the girls, well, they weren't taller than me. I wasn't the tallest person in the room. And I feel like I always want to try and have a presence. Apparently, most CEOs or most entrepreneurs are over 6 foot because they have a presence. So you have to then have a different...
How interesting. But then people like Napoleon and Nelson were really short because they had drive.
Yeah, but that's also... Everyone was short back then. They weren't.
That's true.
Everyone was very short. But we are very similar because you got a double first. Don't know why you're... What are you laughing at?
Nothing. Yeah. I'm laughing in acknowledgement and recognition of our similarities.
Yeah, yeah. You got a double first for history at Cambridge. I got a double first for theatre performance at Leeds University.
Did you?
No, obviously I didn't. I got a 2-2, scraped it. In no ways. But you did. You went to Cambridge and you studied history. Double first is Meg. That's like a really important first, isn't it?
Yeah, it means that you get a first in both parts of your degree. So the exam at the end of your second year and then your finals. And I was astonished. That's not...
But I did. This is... I just don't... I think you're always... With you, you're always... I think when you finished your first ever book, you were amazed that you finished it. You probably were. When your podcast became a success, you were amazed that your podcast was a success.
That's very true, yeah.
Yeah, so I feel like myself being short, where mine is actually more realistic. I actually am short, where I can pretend that I'm not. You then have to stop thinking that you are surprised when things come your way and you do well at them, because... You get a double first at Cambridge, which is amazing. You then write all these books. You're doing the things that you want to do, and you're visualizing these things that you want to do, and then they come true, but then you're amazed that they come true, which is bizarre. So why are you visualizing them? I would understand that if suddenly I was given a visibility cloak, I would be amazed. I'd be like, well, where's that come from? Because I wasn't expecting it. But if people started liking the podcast, I was like, oh god, that's exciting, rather than I'm shocked that people actually start liking it. I think that's what you have to turn around.
Wow,
and your god,
genuinely, no, that's like a abusively profound.
I thought you said abusively.
No, so abusive. Stop abusing me. But that's so I'm actually thinking, I'm digesting this as you say it, because I think in some ways professionally stuff might have gone according to plan, but personally it really hasn't, and I think it's that I've struggled with.
Yes, I know, but I think if I was going to get into it, I think that you expected to have children.
Yes,
that's what you it wasn't something that you thought that's what I'm going to have. You expected to get married and you expected to have these things, and that's what we all do. We all, you know, I listened to one of your interviews recently where you spoke about not being able to have kids, and you said it's really interesting because you're never told at school or anywhere that about IVF, and that you didn't, you had your ovaries weren't, it's something with and you weren't explained these. I explained that really well. Your ovaries, I just said your ovaries.
You said ovaries and blushed furiously.
Yeah, I didn't want to get the terminology wrong. I was going to say something really bad. I was going to say, I didn't know what it was.
But you're not taught as young women the limits of your fertility, and neither are young men. And I think that that's terrible for both boys and girls. Like, all of my sex education at school was about not getting pregnant, and that being the most disastrous thing you could do, and be a teenage mother and all of that sort of stuff. Like, avoid that at all costs. Get someone to wear a condom. Get on the pill. Like, everything. No one ever said, and by the way, you should know that your fertility will expire at some point, and that you are born with a finite egg reserve, and that if you do want to have a family, it is a good idea to start planning for that in the same way as you might start planning for a career. It was very sort of one-sided, I felt. And I don't feel... Did you get any sort of sex education at school about...
Oh, I just laughed my way through it. I just remember asking my teacher if it was bad if I masturbated 5 times a day. That's literally what I said to him. And he went... And I went, for a friend.
Masturbating for a friend? Like, as a performance?
If I masturbate on a friend 5 times a day, does that make me gay?
What was his response?
He said no. He said you can orgasm as much as you want, and that's healthy. It's fine. Is that wrong?
No, tell me something. So as a man, if you are masturbating 5 times a day and coming to climax, does that mean that you can also technically have sex five times a day?
You definitely can. I find it amazing, if I'm totally honest, when people go, God, I spent up all night and we had sex 8 times. I'm like, what?
Right,
Are you not exhausted?
Do you think you're good at sex?
I think that I'm not a natural at all. I was never a natural. I was performing cunnilingus.
Yeah.
As I look
well
around
done.
Sheepishly.
Well done.
And the person I was doing it to, tapped me on the head and said, "You might as well stop that because you're not going to make me orgasm."
Oh, Jamie, that's really hard.
Yeah, I actually responded in the best comeback ever. I went, "Well, don't worry, if we have sex, you're not going to come either." So I was amazingly scared. But also, it goes back to this selfish thing that I, when I had my thing about having sex, and I went to an all-boys school. So the way you were cool at the all-boys school is if you played sport, you were cool. So I had that in the back. So I was cool because I played sport. The other way you were cool is if you hooked up with girls and you kissed girls. And so I remember, this is so weird, you know, I remember when I was 8 years old and I first went to boarding school, Summerfield School, and I didn't understand the concept of boarding school and stuff like this, but I remember sitting in my class looking around and looking at them and going, none of these guys are cool, they're not going to be friends with me. 8 years old, wow. Questioning whether people are cool or not. That is bizarre. You shouldn't even have the experience to understand that, but I was always, and I think it's because I had a sister who was 10 years older who was very cool, I admired massively, she was amazing. And so I was always conscious of that kind of thing. So then, when I was at all boys boarding school, so it was about kissing girls and things like that. And so for me, mine wasn't about the connection during sex. It wasn't about whether I liked that person. It was more about if I have sex with that person, I can then go and tell people that I've had sex on the weekend and I'm going to look really cool. Mm. And in fact, that's totally the wrong way to do it. Sex is an amazing thing because it's an amazing connection you have with someone. And you can have sex with anyone, but when you have sex with someone you actually generally like and you actually have a vibe with, as we all know, the connection is so much more and it's actually incredible. And so I spent all of my teens, not all of them, but most of my teens and then 20s, whenever I was single and I wanted to kind of have sex, it was just about me being selfish. I just wanted to have sex and I just wanted an orgasm. Mm. And so I never really taught myself in the longest way, wind away, am I good at sex? I think that I was selfish and I didn't care, but now I've become out of that place where I'm not selfish. And I think that when you have sex, it's about the experience and joy and things like that. And so that's what I think now. Aww. So basically, I'm a genius in the bit. I know, but I think
for anyone listening,
yeah, anyone listening out there who wants to have sex with me, you're in for a swell of a time. Swell.
As long as you haven't masturbated 5 times yeah. already that day.
Yeah, then. But I do masturbate 9 times a day. But it's hard. But for boys growing up, it's a tricky scenario because you know, sex. We're not really taught stuff in sex,
and you're meant to know. Yeah. That the cliche is like the boy's meant to take the initiative, and they're meant to know what they're doing, and yeah. That's
and you
tough.
Don't, and then you also don't. I've had so many really awful experiences during sex. But I think that's again those failures is what again. If we go back to your thing, it's your failures, and you kind of realise from them. But going back to you, sex.
That was a good diversion.
Yeah, that was a good diversion. But you know, going back to this whole thing of where you. You know, I think we said you weren't taught these things about pregnancy and stuff like that. So you innately thought that you would get married and you would have these things. And, you know, you look at your parents and they were married. And so you were going to have that as well. And that's what I thought.
Yeah.
And the things that you really wanted in life were, you know, being a journalist and writing all those kind of things. You were then surprised to get. And so then for you, it's a really tricky time. I know I keep doing this, but it's a really shock to the system that when your blueprint isn't the fact that you're going to be able to have kids, that for you is so much worse because you're then not, like we spoke before, where you're going to, if I'm explaining this right, you're going to your inner self where you're looking for those comments that are negative to justify what you're feeling. When you have, you've realized you can't have kids, that's like someone saying to you, you have cancer, because you don't suddenly think that it's going to happen to you, and then it does happen to you, and it's a very scary and horrible place to be.
I think you're completely right that it was something that I couldn't control, so that's no matter how much effort I put into it, I still wasn't getting the result that I wanted. So I was very used to putting in hard work and getting a good result, and with biology you just can't fool it with effort. And that's been a very good lesson for me, actually. It really, really has, because it's made me question the blueprint I had for myself, not only being a mother, but also everything, like being married, like who I thought I was and who I thought I should be. And it releases you. What I now realise is that I was released from expectation and social conditioning when at the age of 36, I found myself getting divorced and single. And actually what it gave me, as well as being a very traumatic and sad and difficult time, it gave me endless opportunity to create a different kind of life. and one that was more true to who I actually was. And that is something that I think is so important to tell people, is that it is never too late to change your life.
Oh, God, totally. And it's so funny. You know, you think that you're going to be in this life forever, but actually on the sixpence, it changes in a heartbeat. And suddenly it's totally different.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
But so, and maybe this is too deep because I'm sure I can ask you, with your marriage, do you not think that you were the person you wanted to be, or you were conforming to someone that you weren't? Do you think that's was the case?
I think I thought I was being completely honest and true to myself. But I met my ex-husband when I was 29 and we got married when I was 33. And I think I'd been I hadn't been single in any. I had been in a long-term monogamous relationship with someone from the age of 19. So I had actually never taken time to understand who I was outside of a relationship.
You don't. And then you live in these sort of codependent relationships where you just...
Codependency, 100%. Yeah. Yes. And so when I got married and my ex is older than I am and had been married before, and I was very aware of that, and I wanted to be the perfect wife so that I would never get left, which is so ironic given what happened, because actually, again, I was trying to combat that internal narrative, which is like, if I am perfect in this role, if I put loads of effort and loads of work into it, then it's all going to be fine. But actually, I just erased myself and my own needs because I was so concerned with how I was making his life. And that is, I think, what happened. And the reason for me that it imploded, and I'm extremely careful when I talk about my marriage because it is a story that involves two people.
Completely.
And I do not talk for my ex, and I respect him, and I need to leave that for him to talk about if he ever wants to. But for me, the ultimate trigger for the implosion was not having children. And that was something that I realized I really, really wanted. And for the first time, it felt like I was able to take the battle on to find my own voice, not for me, but for the child that I wanted to have, if that makes sense. So it was all really difficult, but ultimately it did make me stronger in standing up for myself.
It's interesting as well, and huge respect to you for, because it's very easy in certain situations, and I have, you know, we've never spoken about your divorce and things like that, but I can only relate it to my mother, who, my mother was in a marriage with my father, they divorced, and my dad left my mum, and my mum never spoke ill of him, never spoke poorly of him, you know, and lots of different things happened, which she could have easily done, but she didn't, because she was like, no, that's your father, and it's his place, and there are two sides to every story, and she didn't do it. And I think that's a really, because it's very easy to be angry in a relationship, and anger is the sort of the main emotion that comes out. So it's amazing that you kind of say that and say, look, I don't speak for him, you know, he can do that. So it's a great way to be. But the reason why, when you started writing your books and things like that, the book that I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that sort of set you apart was your book, The Party.
Yes. Look at you with your research.
What's up, everybody? No worries. And you wrote this book and it then became a hit. What was that like for you? The fact that you had grown up with all these books, you were writing, you were doing journals and stuff like that, but suddenly one of your books became popular.
I mean, it was amazing because it was genuinely like it's been a lifelong dream for me to have a book published, let alone a book that then lots of people bought and read. And it was particularly sweet because it was my fourth novel. So I'd had the prior experience of having written three other novels that I'm proud of and that they did okay, but they didn't do that well. And often I'd be at kind of parties and someone would say, what do you do? And I'm like, oh, well, I'm a journalist and I also write novels. And they'd say, oh, anything I would have heard of, at which stage I'm like, I punched them in the face. No,
yeah.
At which stage.
Yeah, I've got one here, actually. Yes, it's signed.
Or they'd say, and I'd say, oh, I've written three novels. And they'd say, any of them published?
What? Fuck
mostly
you.
Men, I would say mostly men would say that. I was like, yes, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
And so then The Party came out and it felt that I was at long last being recognised for something I truly loved and truly cared about. And it was a really, really lovely experience. And I'm very grateful to everyone who bought it.
Yeah, but I don't know that because you say that's the first time you recognise. But then I read something. Where is it? I read this thing, if I can.
Can I just say quickly as well that the party is all based about being, it's all based around the idea of being a massive outsider and being an outsider at school and not fitting in. So I used a lot of my experiences for that.
Which, it's so funny when you go back to your own experiences, that will actually just shine through sometimes. So there was this, but I read this thing about you too. While working at the Telegraph, Day won the Young Journalist of the Year Award at the British Press Awards, which I've also won in 2004. Dominic Lawson, the editor of the Sunday Telegraph, was quoted at the time saying, Day was probably the most brilliant young talent most of us has seen in 20 years.
Yeah. Okay.
So you. This is what I find so funny. You're suddenly like, oh god, people. But you were congratulated forever. People thought you were good. They thought you were great. And so almost to the point that your books hadn't been successful as you hoped they were. It's like, well, they should be. Or am I talking
absolute
shit?
What do I think about that? I suppose I. What do I think about?
Yeah, what do you think about
it?
Yourself?
Just didn't go in. For some reason, it didn't go in. I think. Again, I've always wanted to write books. And I'm very grateful for my journalism career, but books for me were like the ultimate thing because I was reading them as a dweebish child when I was four. But, and when Dominic Lawson said that, it was an incredibly complimentary thing to hear. And but when I hear something like that, I don't believe it.
Yeah, I know.
So that's what it is. I know what it is. I know what it is. I don't believe it.
You sit there and you don't believe it, yeah.
But the fact that then there's a fact, an objective fact is that The Party sold this many copies. So that's like, oh, I need to take that as a fact. That's not someone's opinion.
Yeah, because again, it goes back to that's why you're good at exams, because you had the answer. So it's like, oh, this is... So you'll get given the answer and you get given the fact. And so then, therefore, you can accept it.
Yes.
But until you get that sort of information... Oh,
this
no.
is so... How am I going to be happy? No, I'm joking. I am happy. But this is so interesting because no one's ever put it like that before. And you're so right. And I'm someone who has weekly therapy, by the way. Like, therapy is, for me, an investment in my future mental health.
Exactly. Totally. I'm all up for therapy.
Yeah. But one of the things that... So this is a therapist I've been seeing for the last 2 years. And one of the first things she said to me in my first session was, you care way too much what other people think of you. And my challenge as a therapist is going to be never letting you know what I think of you. And she never has. And it's really like off-putting.
I would hate that.
Yeah, it's
really
difficult.
Do you like
difficult.
Me?
Totally. And like, I had to stop trying to charm her. I just go there now and I'm like, I don't know. I don't know what you think of me. I don't know. I'm like looking at her bookshelves, trying to memorize book titles, being like, is she this kind of person? That kind of, it's ridiculous. But it's forced me to sit with myself and work out what I think of myself. And I am getting to the stage, it's taken me this long. I turned 40 last November, so it's taken me like this long to work out that actually my value is not dictated by someone's inability to see my worth. So, and what I mean by that is that what I do, if I love it and if I think it's of value, that's enough. So we were joking about the podcast awards, but I know that I really value my podcast and I get great joy from the doing of it. And that's enough. Like that has to be the kind of starting point for everything.
Yeah, I know, that's exactly it. You know, you, without a doubt, at the beginning, you should just be happy for what you're producing and doing. The Japanese culture, that's why Japanese culture is so amazing, because the Japanese culture doesn't matter who, whatever job you're doing, it doesn't matter if you're a binman or a lobby receptionist, you just really respect your job and you love the job that you do and you are happy that you're doing this job. But in, for some reason, in the UK, we have this thing where we write stuff or do stuff, we always go, oh, I don't know if it's that good, you know. I don't think any of us have ever done something, we go, that's a banger, that's going to kill it. And that confidence I really admire in some people when they have it. But then when you set up your podcast, as I said, How to Fail, and then off the back of the success of it, you did something like 8 episodes and someone said, well, we need a book now. Isn't that what happened?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
But we've done 130 episodes. Where's my private parts
You're
book?
Reading out your writing every week. I mean...
Put it into a book.
Yeah.
I'll sell it.
I'll put you in touch with my agent.
Okay, great.
Basically, I think because I'd written books before, and it was actually my editor at Fourth Estate she's published all of my novels, and she was the one. It was before the podcast even launched. And I was like, I'm about to launch this podcast, and she looked at me and she's like, that would make a really good book. And can you write me a proposal over the weekend? And I was like, would it? And I'll try. And so that's what I did. And then actually, I was really intimidated at the prospect because it's the first time I've written a nonfiction book. But I realised as soon as I started writing it, I had a lot of stuff that I wanted to say. And I loved writing it as a result. But that is exactly what happened. It was an extremely tight deadline. I wrote it in 3 months. The first series had just aired.
My dissertation 6 months, and that was like 12,000 words.
What was your dissertation on?
Patrick Marber, the playwright.
Oh.
Yeah. Told you, double first. Leeds University Theatre and Performance.
Did you watch the film Closer?
I did watch the film Closer.
I love that film.
But I performed in the play Dealer's Choice.
Oh.
Yeah, where I played a son of a wealthy father who drank too much and gambled. It was me at the time. So I was like, well, this sounds great. I can fit into this role very easily.
Yeah.
But so you wrote it in 3 months. But what is your writing process? Well, how do you? I remember Philip Pullman, the guy who wrote... I was about to say Lord of the Rings.
The guy who wrote Harry Potter,
Lord of the Rings, and Game of Thrones.
What did he write?
He wrote...
The Amber Spyglass.
The Amber Spyglass, Northern Lights.
Northern Lights, that was it.
And he said, he explained his writing process, and he said he was very laid back, he'd go into his shed at his garden, he would flick elastic bands. I remember it so well. For some reason, weird things stick in my head. Do you have a process that you go into where you go into like a different place where you start to write? Or do you just take loads of crack and then start writing? You take loads of heroin and then just go and paint the words.
I masturbate 5 times. Yeah. I open a packet of Marks and Spencer chicken.
Yeah, chorizo.
And then I'm set.
Yeah,
I'm set.
And you're ready to go.
I do and I don't. So when I'm writing journalism or doing the podcast, I will tend to work from my desk at home. And it's very important for me to go into a different space when I'm starting to write books. So I will either go to a cafe at the end of the road, or in the case of How to Fail, I actually went to LA to house sit for a friend of mine for a month, which was incredible because...
That's so the holiday of you.
Oh my, exactly.
That's exactly the holiday of you.
It was heaven. It was heaven, partly because you get to write in the sunshine and you get no emails after 2 p.m. And I love LA for many reasons, but those are two of them. But... I do go into a separate mind space, and writing is very much something that when I'm in it and I feel like I'm doing it well, I feel untangled as a person. I feel that it's what I'm meant to be doing. And that's a really, really, it's almost like when you're in a yoga class and you're in the flow and you're like getting all the moves and stuff, which has never happened to me. But it's that sort of same feeling of like just being in tune with yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But I often think that actually starting writing a book is the hardest thing. And so many people are put off because it's an intimidating prospect. And so whenever I start something, I make a deal with myself, which is like every time I sit down, I will write 1,000 words. And it doesn't matter if those words are rubbish and I'm going to write them with no judgment because I can always go back and revisit them. But a key part of writing is just like writing the stuff and getting it done and trying not to be precious about it because a blank page is your worst enemy.
Which, you know, Woody Allen said something like 80% of success is just turning up, or 50% of success is just turning up. And it's essentially just getting out and just writing and putting it down on paper. But then isn't it an amazing feeling when everything just suddenly comes together and you have this book and then it's on the shelves and people are reading it, and when you get that response back like you did with your book, that just must be so great. Also, the fact that you get to go, you can work anywhere in the world.
Yes, that's incredible. That is
amazing.
A beautiful, beautiful thing. No, I feel very, very lucky to have that. I really do. Because all I need is a laptop and a functioning brain.
Yeah.
And it is great. But to answer your question about it feels utterly incredible when the book exists in physical form and you see it in bookshops. And I've actually never seen anyone reading one of my books in real life, but lots of my friends have, and they send me pictures that they've taken of people on the tube and stuff, like weird stalkers. And that's just completely thrilling. It absolutely is. And I will never get tired of that.
So when you see someone reading your book, you've never seen it, but you wouldn't go up to them and go, I'm Elizabeth Day.
Do you know, I actually think I would now, because I remember my friend Francesca telling me that Martin Amis, who obviously is like one of the world's greatest novelists, he had only ever once seen one person, a lady on a bus, reading his book, and he hadn't gone up to her because he thought, oh, well, it's bound to happen again, and it's never happened again. So I actually think now I would, and I'd say, I'm really sorry, I know this is weird, but I need to do this now, just for future me, for the sake of future me, I need to do this.
I think when I see someone reading your book, I'm going to go up to them and say, that's my friend.
Yes, please do.
I will do that. I will do that 100%.
And then they'll be like, you're Jamie Lang from Chelsea, can I have a selfie?
They'll say, I've always thought you were a cock. Elizabeth, hey, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me and for being so wonderful. No, it's been a joy.
You're amazing. Go and listen to Elizabeth's podcast, How to Fail. Go and get your book, How to Fail. Go and read The Party. I've never read it, but apparently that's the winner.
They're all winners.
Yeah, they're all winners. But as we found out, the podcast was, they're not really. There is a first, second,
actually,
third, fourth, and fifth.
Actually, my books have on prizes.
There definitely is. Elizabeth, what we like to do at the end of the podcast is leave our listeners with something inspirational.
What, that I have to say?
Yeah, every time people get thrown by this, every single time they're like, oh, what do I say? Anything.
Okay, my inspirational words of wisdom are, even if you feel, and you're listening right now, and you feel that you're in a particularly challenging part of your life, or you feel in the depths of despair, I would encourage you just to cling on for a few moments longer, because you never know what's going to happen next. And I feel that the real failure would be not finding out. So cling on, you're not alone, and connect with each other.
Boom.
And masturbate 5 times a day.
See,
don't do that.
Do it all the time. It's great fun. And chicken does not smell of sperm. As we do a nice little cyclical to get to the end of our podcast. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.